Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert, and I hope you're enjoying this Halloween season, the best of all seasons, obviously. And the Monster Professor podcast October Takeover continues with Laura Benedict. She's an author, Edgar nominated author, ITW Thriller Award nominated author. Her newest novel, yes, she has many, novel after novel after novel, fantastic novel. She's got a gothic trilogy. She spans the range of mystery and thriller, all the way from the cozy crime novel, Small Town Trouble, to her newest one that will freak you out, called The Stranger Inside. Short fiction wise, her work has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. She's on the cover of Mystery Magazine. She's shown up in anthologies such as Thrillers, 100 Must Reads, The Lineup, 20 Provocative Women Writers, St. Louis Noir. She's not only a prolific author and a fantastic blogger, she's been quite a bit of a writing mentor for me as well. Originally from Cincinnati, she lives down here in Southern Illinois, and you can check her out at laurabenedict.com. We have a really cool conversation about ghosts in literature, about the Frankenstein type of thing, about her take on these kinds of gothic and mystery stories and the dark side of storytelling. I think you're really going to enjoy it. So here we go, my conversation with Laura Benedict. Well, okay. Well, this is a good place to start then. So thank you so much for coming on The Monster Professor, Laura Benedict.
I'm so excited to be on here. Thank you. Whenever my husband Pinckney Benedict does things, I'm immediately jealous if I don't get to do them too. So I feel very good about this.
And at this point, I've given the listeners a rundown of your bibliography, but by my count, now correct me if I'm wrong, 8 books you've written, or 8 novels at this point. Is that right? Most recently, yes. The Stranger Inside.
Mm-hmm. That's right. 8 novels.
And on top of that, you started the Surreal South anthology series, and that's not to mention all of the many stories you have out there, and not to mention your blog, and all these other things that you do, and not all of it, but a whole lot of it tends toward the dark, the creepy, the ghostly. One of the main reasons I'm so excited about having you on The Monster Professor. And so I was wondering maybe if we could start a little bit with what in the world got you into the darker side of literature and becoming a mystery and gothic writer yourself.
Oh, golly. I started on the dark side a long time ago. I was probably a pretty happy kid. But I like to be alone a lot. I like to read a whole lot. And, one of the first, books, particularly in the dark and mystery side, I got to read, was my grandfather gave me a hardbound illustrated collection of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Huh.
And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. And then, also, I started reading Poe, which, you know, that's a great, great fiction for children.
Yeah.
That and I'm old enough that Black Beauty, you know, that's just what you want to read about abused horses, right? So I kind of assumed that it was a really dark kind of world. You know, I loved Nancy Drew. Nancy Drew, you could hardly call dark, but, you know, when you're 10, 11 years old, that, you know, pre-R.L. Stine days, you know, that was pretty dark. Yeah. You know, Nancy Drew, like, I like the ones with the mysteries and the witches and the, you know, cellars and that kind of things. I really gravitated toward that. So that was, you know, and then Jane Eyre. I love Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
I think I picked that up first when I was 12 and then immediately went from there to Stephen King. I never read like Anne of Green Gables or Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. I don't know, you know, the sort of bright girl literature just never appealed to me. I kind of have a dark, paranoid soul. So I think that's, you know, I think that's really where it started with what I was reading when I was younger.
And in your own novels, you're not afraid at all to get into the dark and the supernatural side. And so I'm wondering, at two places I want to go with you. I want to pick your brain a little bit about ghosts in fiction and ghosts in literature and your take on it and your thoughts on it. And I also want to go in a slightly different direction into the world of Frankenstein and piecing together the dead. And I have to say that, if I'm remembering correctly, Isabella Moon was your first, novel? Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Isabella Moon was my third novel, but my first published novel. I had completed two novels that will never see the light of day, but Isabella Moon was the first one to be published. And that is a ghost story.
Yeah, and I distinctly remember my wife Melissa picking it up first, reading it, getting to the point where the dead girl ghost thing is hiding behind the trash can, and she couldn't take it anymore. And she was too freaked out. We had to turn all the lights on in the house for the rest of the night. And it's the image remains in my mind too. It's horrifying. So you're not afraid of no ghost. You're not afraid to put ghost in fiction. And yet, and so, I'm curious a little bit about your thoughts on ghosts and fiction. And I don't really know what my question is other than perhaps why do we love them so much? And why do ghosts and fiction go together so well?
You know, they really do go so well together. I totally agree with that. I think a ghost immediately, once you put a ghost into a story, it immediately takes sort of your standard story to a whole different place. It takes it out of the realm of the real. And, you know, the ghost stories I like best are the kind I didn't find a lot of ghost stories the kind I wanted to read. So that's one of the reasons I wrote Isabella Moon. I like my ghosts to be part of the real fabric of the world, right? That they're not, they're special and they're unique, but there's somebody who believes, you know, there are people in the story who actually believe in the ghosts, and those ghosts become a part of their life, their lives, right? Yeah. So, you know, you look at something like Turn of the Screw.
Yeah.
The Henry James novel. I mean, that's a ghost story that a lot of people are familiar with. And, you know, those are some powerful ghosts that have an effect on the children. They have an effect on their governess. And, you know, it's super, super dark. But their stories becomes the fabric of the book, right? I mean, they really set the tone for the novel.
Yeah.
And you know, when you can take a story, I mean, of course it works in any, you know, kind of monster story. But one of the reasons I like ghosts is they are so plausible. You know, a ghost is a very plausible thing. Whereas a creature, that has been sewn together or created in a laboratory or come down from space. Okay, well, maybe not space. Maybe that's plausible. but, you know, ghosts really, they seem plausible. They seem plausible to me anyway. And so they seem plausible to the characters. And therefore, it's my hope and my experience that it becomes a more real experience for the reader. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it's not only plausible, I think so many, well, I forget the actual statistical numbers. I think I quoted them during one episode on ghosts that we did for the show. But if I'm remembering correctly, it was something like 60% of Americans say that either ghosts are real or they might be real enough that I don't want to mess with them or something to that effect. And so I think the majority of Americans are not only into the, it's plausible, but it might be more than plausible. It might be just as real as the house that holds the ghost.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's a good point. If you have a werewolf in a novel, a lot of us have to suspend disbelief, but if you have a ghost in a novel, you don't have to work very hard to start really believing in that thing.
No, because it's that, you know, the ghost can be, you know, that feeling on the back of your neck that somebody is in the room with you. You know, I mean, it just feel, you know, or you hear a sound that doesn't quite sound human, you know, that, you know, there's something there with you and it has a, you feel like it has a physical presence or you sense a physical presence, but you can't see anything. And I think that happens to many people. So the 60% number doesn't surprise me. What is interesting to me, is that other 40%, they often get angry. They're so disbelieving that once a ghost walks into the room, you know, they shut, or into the story, they shut the book and they say, oh, it's woo-woo. And, you know, they don't want to have anything to do with it at all. That it just seems so, I suspect that actually they're the ones who are most afraid.
That may, I'm with you on that, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean you're highly aware of the kind of the elitist literary culture, although you get to hang more with the mystery writers group and that culture, which seems to me to be a much cooler group. I mean, you might have noticed Laura Benedict on the cover of Mystery Scene magazine. You're going to get to see her not too long off after this episode airs at the World Mystery Convention. You got a lot of cool people around there, but sure enough, in like the literature world, anything that's supernatural, particularly ghosts, are kind of snobbishly turned aside. And yet, Toni Morrison, freaking mm-hmm. Nobel Prize winner and most celebrated of the literati, her biggest book, Beloved, isn't that just a ghost story? Like, haven't we been telling ghost stories as literature since we have literature?
Absolutely. And, you know, but I would say a lot of those people would say that she was using the ghost as metaphor. And, you know, rather than that she had a reason because she wanted to get the message across, right? Yeah. And the ghost was just a convenient means rather than, hey, this is a good ghost story. You know, I mean, there's so many people who seem to think, and I'm not going to name any names, that literature, if it's entertaining, it's not good. And when it comes to ghosts, it's like, have you heard of Shakespeare? Perhaps. Or, you know, I mean, and there's Henry James. You know, I mean, Henry James actually gets taught it, or okay, I it used to be taught in English programs, you know, I mean that it, so it's kind of, you know, I don't know. I'm suspect. I'm suspicious of it.
Yeah.
I'm suspicious of people who don't like entertaining stories, especially ones with ghosts.
Yeah, that division between entertaining and good as two separate things does exist there, unfortunately, as you're pointing out, and it seems to me, as far as I can tell, to be a rather recent distinction, and I think perhaps one made out of resentment for those who believe that they write quite well but don't sell as many books as somebody who maybe doesn't. I don't know.
Well, if you're too good, if you're just too good a writer, then people just don't understand you, and therefore will, you know, you're just not worth their time. But the other thing, you know, you mentioned the Mystery Writers of America. And when I said, people calling ghost stories woo-woo, you might be surprised to know that within the mystery and crime community, that the people who actually write supernatural fiction, the number of people is actually quite small. And mystery/crime people do not care to have, most do not care to have their mystery muddled by the supernatural.
Oh.
And they do call it woo-woo. And so, you know, early on, and actually to some extent, even now, when you go to something like BoucherCon, which is the World Mystery Convention, you will only have, you might have like one supernatural panel, and that's it.
Hmm.
You know, people are just not looking for it, or at least the organizers don't think people are looking for it. So it's kind of a white elephant, if you will. Now, the people who do pay attention are often the Horror Writers of America, that association.
Yeah.
And I have been a member there, and chose a few years ago to stop my membership because it was not a healthy community for me. So,
yeah. The Horror Writers of America, I love the idea of them, but just dealing with them a little bit, they seem quite litigious, like as if the community argues about every fine little detail and everything, or else I'm not really sure why there are so many warnings and rules to everything. So, but you know, maybe that's a writerly thing. No matter where you go, I don't know.
No, I don't think that is. I think you're right. Because I'm a member of several other writers' associations, and they're just not like that. I think it has. Okay, I'm just going to come right out and say it. For many, many years, it was a bunch of geeky guys who like to get together and argue about stuff. And now I think that's changed quite a lot. They have a very strange process. You may have heard of the Bram Stoker Award, the Stoker Awards.
Yeah, I'm up for that right now, by the way. So if I do well in it, I'm gonna say wonderful things about them.
Okay, I'm done talking. Everybody, if you are an HWA member, vote for Josh because he's awesome. And his work is awesome. So, yeah. Anyway, it's all better now. The HWA is fabulous. And I probably should go ahead and renew my membership. But, you know, it's funny because one of the problems, you know, not really a problem, but, you know, my work, I've always struggled for an audience because I do cross genres that way. That my mysteries, so many of my mysteries have elements of the supernatural. Yeah. Or you could say my horror novels have elements of mystery in them.
Yeah.
But that's a challenge.
That crossover seems to make so much sense, though. I mean, essentially, like what you were just describing a few minutes ago about the appeal to the ghost, I mean, it's kind of the same appeal of that kind of mystery thriller in the non-supernatural or the mundane, kind of like, well, I mean, one of the, I guess more specifically, like one of the powerful
reactions to the ghosts, or maybe what drives one of the reactions to ghosts in your house, is you have a stranger in your house. Like, there is somebody else, another personality that might mean you harm, or at least is not there to help you out in your house, and you are kind of powerless to do something. In fact, a lot of those people who go around doing real exorcisms of houses normally say they don't really care whether or not it's real. That's not their job. Their job is to help this person feel at home in their own home, right? And so really, they're just kind of chasing off the stranger. And maybe that's a little bit of a segue to your newest novel, too. So give us a little bit of insight into your thoughts about strangers in your house.
Oh, that's a very nice segue. Thank you.
Well, it was accidental, but it's don't work.
Oh, come on. Claim it. Go for it. The stranger inside, I'm a super paranoid person. You might know that about me. And I have all these dreams about people trying to get into my house or occupying my house. Usually they're on the outside trying to get in. But I'm also, coming home and the house is dark and, you wonder, has somebody been, did somebody get in the house? I mean, there's always that little bit of paranoia and mystery for me. And, I also have always been fascinated by these news stories where people, they go on vacation, even, extended or, week long vacations, and they come back and there's someone living in their house.
Yeah.
They're living there, they're occupying the space, and it's darn hard to get them out. Or people who, you've invited into your home and you can't get rid of them. That's a whole different thing. But that happens frequently to people. So I imagined, almost every one of my books is centered around a house in some way, or houses. Somebody said to me, it's your motif. Houses are your motif. Now, not being an English major, I'm like, okay, sounds good. I have a lot of houses. So I imagined a woman coming home from a brief trip, and she goes to put her key in the lock of her adorable Craftsman bungalow in St. Louis. She goes to turn the key and it doesn't work. And she goes around the back, key doesn't work. And she sees the shadows in her house and a bike she doesn't recognize on the porch. And then she sees there is a shadow. There is a man in her house. And so the book is, who is he? What is he doing there? And what does he have to do with her past? So that's my story. That's the stranger inside. And it was a lot of fun to write. It was, it really is the outer evidence of my intense paranoia.
And that's a hell of a hook, by the way. And I know it doesn't only work on me, because when we were at the Edwardsville Book Festival not too long ago, I would see you drop that hook on somebody and their eyebrows would go up and like, ooh, and then grab the book and get it right away. So for anyone listening to this right now, where's the best place to get a copy of Stranger Inside or any of the other Laura Benedict books?
Well, really any bookstore, independent or chain bookstores, if my books aren't on the shelves, right now The Stranger Inside should be there. If it's not, you can always order it. I am not averse to folks ordering online. I buy things from Amazon and Barnes and Noble all the time. So really all you have to do is turn on your computer or go to your bookstore and say, I need all the Laura Benedict books you have.
That's a good investment. It is. All of those books, they do have, it would seem to me gothic. I would call it gothic, and I'd be very comfortable calling you a gothic writer.
because the place matters. So not only do we have this dark atmosphere, but what happens in the place or the threats in your world seem kind of connected to the place. And to me, that's a little bit of Gothic. So I was curious about your thoughts on the Gothic and some of your Gothic influences.
Well, of course, there's, you know, there's Jane Eyre. That's the ultimate. Wuthering Heights, one of the first Gothics, the Castle of Otranto. I always get that wrong. Otranto?
I say Otranto, but I don't, Otranto? I don't, okay. I could be screwing that up. So.
Works for me. You know, those are sort of my primary. I mean, modern, you know, Peter Straub's Ghost Story, you know, that's a modern Gothic. Gosh, you know, now that you've asked me.
Henry James, Turn of the Screw is Gothic too.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, definitely Henry James. But you know, there's so, you know, I mean, even if you look at things like, you know, you can read Jane Austen, right? And you can see that's sort of the happy side. You know, if you flip a Jane Austen novel, you've got a Gothic, right? Northanger Abbey is a Gothic. I'm trying to think of what else. See, when I'm on the spot, everything just runs out of my head.
let me toss one at you that I'm pretty sure we both love is Shirley Jackson. And so, am I right? And can I go so far as to say that Shirley Jackson is a big kind of founding father of the Laura Benedict Gothic?
Absolutely. You wouldn't think so, considering she just slipped out of my brain, but
she's too close to your heart.
It is, you know, and I didn't actually discover Shirley Jackson, you know, until I think we probably read The Lottery in college, but I have a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. So, Gothic literature was not really,
not on the list. Huh?
So I was kind of a late follower of Shirley Jackson. Although, one of my favorite memories, of dating Pinckney was we watched in my apartment, on a little tiny TV. I mean, we're talking like maybe 13 by 13. We watched, the 1960, Haunting of Hill House.
Oh yeah, man, that's a good one. Yeah. Early 60s, I think.
We were scared to death. Little TV, it was sun shining outside, and when those pounds started, when the pounding started from the nursery, I mean, we were just like, we were like 2 6-year-olds clinging to each other.
Yeah, and that door like stretching and moving, it was really good.
So it was wonderful. It was so wonderful. And you know, Pinckney turned me on to, of course, Hell House.
Matheson.
Matheson, you know, Pinckney really turned me on to Matheson. I blame him for really encouraging my Gothic tendencies. And I'll tell you a secret. Okay. This is a secret. You can't tell him.
Just between us and everybody listening.
It's just between us. You know, when Pinckney and I first met, I was a very novice writer. I'd taken a couple postgraduate classes, meaning I had graduated with a business degree, but I wanted to go back and learn how to write fiction, right? So I'd taken some night classes, and I had some very overpraised stories, which was awesome, but not very good for, you know, developing as a writer. And, you know, Pinckney had very early literary success. and I was completely in awe of him. Now he probably knows that part. But, you know, because I don't have an MFA, and Pinckney is sort of the ultimate literary guy and literary professor. He's such a terrific teacher. I kind of knew early on that I really wanted to be just a writer, you know, but I was uneducated as to genre versus literary. I had no idea the difference. And I think many readers do not. They don't think like writers, yeah. Right? What they see are categories in the bookstore. You know, they go into Barnes & Noble or they go to Amazon and they see categories, yeah. Right? You see literature, you know, fiction, you see literature, and then you see types of literature, you see mystery, or you see thrillers or sports books, whatever. So anyway, I did not know the difference. I thought Somerset Maugham was high literature. Now, Somerset Maugham is good, but he really was a commercial writer of his time. Yeah. And so Pinckney doesn't know this about me, so don't tell him this. I'm kind of competitive, and it's, I know it's shocking, right?
I think he knows that about you.
And I learned very quickly that I would never be able to compete as a literary writer because there are those distinctions. I took one graduate fiction workshop in St. Louis, you know, at night. And the professor told me that my fiction had too much plot.
Too much plot. Wow. Okay.
Too much plot because nobody, you know, nobody likes plot, right? Everybody who goes to a film is like, oh man, I really hope this doesn't have plot, right?
Yeah, you're like, and you go to a buffet and you're like, oh, this would be fine if it weren't for all this food at the buffet.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, okay, I don't want to try to compete with Pinckney because it will never work. So that is why, and you actually asked me this much, you know, one of your first questions, that is one of the reasons I turned to commercial fiction and the supernatural, because it wasn't something, while Pinckney sort of developed, you know, his surreal habits, right, mm-hmm. for surreal fiction, you know, I just went straight into the supernatural. And yeah. Because I really felt like that was a place I could develop myself on my own and we could stay married. But you know, by that we were having a child and you know, you kind of want to hang together. So that is why I went that direction first. Huh. But don't tell him that. I don't think he knows.
Okay, I won't tell him that. But if he listens to this episode, I won't be able to stomp him on that. So,
okay, I know. I believe you.
That's really cool. I like that idea. I think that, you know, seeing those kinds of those different arenas where not only do you not feel like jumping in there with competition that you feel like is beyond your competition, but I think maybe that's for some of us, and perhaps for you, that's another way of actually noticing maybe that's not what you truly love. Maybe, I mean, if it's exactly. It's one thing to really love, you know, like literature, literary kind of stories. But if you really love that good mystery and that good gothic and a good ghost story, don't waste your time anywhere else. Jump right to it.
Exactly. You know, I mean, and there are people who sort of, you know, who do dark stuff. I mean, you know, the really good literary writers, you know, I mean, you know, one of my huge role models aside from Shirley Jackson is Margaret Atwood.
Yeah.
You know, and nobody tells Margaret Atwood she can't write a science fiction book, right? Or she can't write a dystopian book because she started out as a feminist writer. I mean, her short stories were basically feminist polemic. And they, I mean, they were really good stories. Or somebody like, do you know, and I'm sure you know Angela Carter's work.
No, I don't know Angela Carter.
Okay. So check out Angela Carter. She did one book, that, basically she took fairy tales and gave them very dark, darker twists than they already had. Cool. But she was another feminist writer who sort of wrote straight work, but then took off into the surreal and supernatural. And, you know, somebody like William Gay, William Gay's work is astonishing. And he has those sort of weird and surreal elements. Ray Bradbury. Oh my gosh, I have never listened to Something Wicked This Way Comes. I don't know if you or read it. Yeah. I have never read it. And, you know, Bradbury, you know, Twilight Zone, weird stuff everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And this book, I've become an audiobook junkie because sort of with the ADHD thing, I like to do many things at once. And so whenever I'm, you know, doing something around the house or driving, I really love to have a book in my ear. And, you know, Something Wicked This Way Comes. I mean, it's his writing is classic, you know, sort of mid-century literary writing. But I can really see, I could see, you know, in this book, there's this terrifying carnival that comes to town. And I thought immediately, Stephen King knows this book really well.
Oh, yeah.
you could just see it, you know? I mean, it could have been a King story, you know? So, and I think I've seen him acknowledge Bradbury as one of his big influences. But, you know, I mean, there's, you know, he was quite a literary writer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Writing.
Yeah. And then, yeah, the Stephen King appeal, at least when it really got hot in the, late 70s, early 80s, I think a big part of it was like the Norman Rockwell turned into nightmare, right? Like the,
yes.
the nice Americana neighborhood or suburb, but all that came from Bradbury. I mean, that was the Midwest little suburb family story, but then here comes the horror with it. And I think Bradbury, right. I think you're right to point that out as the inventor of Stephen King. Well, how about we jump a little bit into Frankensteinish kind of stuff for a minute, if we can?
Like a good Frankenstein story.
Because I had a student one time emailing me saying, "Professor Woods, I need some help. I need to find other examples of stories or novels in other than Frankenstein in which parts of a dead body are put together and reanimated." And I'm like, okay, not just bringing back the dead, like, say, like Lovecraft's Reanimator or a million other right. things, but like piecing together. Well, I didn't even have to be a dead body. It was just piecing together somebody, then bringing that to life. I'm like, other than Frankenstein, and then maybe a random short story or another, really Laura Benedict's The Devil's Oven is the only thing I can think of. I don't know. And so if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about what in the world is up with The Devil's Oven, and then your thoughts on piecing people together, and why would you do that, Laura Benedict?
Golly. You know, what's really funny about that book is, and the whole Frankenstein thing, I actually started out with the image of the story of the gingerbread man.
Oh, yeah.
Because when you think about it, the gingerbread man is the forerunner to all of those stories.
Yeah, you know, that's a horror story. It really is.
It's a horrible, scary story. You know, you bake somebody. You bake a thing you think you're going to eat, and it's alive, right? And although I guess in the original story, maybe she was trying to bake a child, if I'm remembering that right. Anyway, But I really, when I get stuck for ideas, I totally go to folktales.
Yeah, and, that's smart.
And, you know, because they are some of the most frightening things you'll ever read. And I in Devil's Oven, I have a seamstress and she lives on a mountain called, surprise, Devil's Oven. And her family has been there for many, many years. And she's lonely. She is a lonely seamstress. She has a horrible sister named Thora. And Ivy is up on the mountain collecting mushrooms. She's looking for morels, and, you know, which are very brightly colored and grow in unusual places. And so she's up on the mountain and she discovers a man. She discovers body parts of a man. And by the time she finds his head, she discovers he's kind of a handsome man. And being the lonely woman that she is and the excellent seamstress, I must say, she takes him to the abandoned trailer they have on their property, and she lays him out on the table in pieces, and she stitches him together for herself. You know, Ivy is, you know, she's not like a highly sexualized person. She's very reserved. She's very practical. So one doesn't come out and say, oh, she was trying to make herself an actual lover. But she, like I said, she was lonely. So she stitches him together. And, you know, now that I think about it, I should have had him missing a part or two. To make him really interesting. Like what could he be missing? Like, you know, a hand or a forearm or, you know.
Oh, see, you writers never stop revising, do you?
You know, I wrote that like what in 2012, and I'm still thinking, oh dang, I should have done that instead.
I do that stuff all the time, like years after it's done and published. I'm like, I wish I would've.
I wish. And you know, this part, I have to give credit to another writer, and actually I've forgotten her name at the moment, but I was on the phone talking with her about Devil's Oven, and she said, well, how does he get animated? And I thought, oh, that's a good question. How, you know, I was thinking, lightning? What is that? And she said, well, of course she has to prick her finger. And I'm like, of course she does. So I would like to claim credit for that, because I really just hadn't, when I was putting the story together, I hadn't figured out how he was going to be animated, because of course you have to have animation, right? Yeah. Like stories of the Golem, you know, they have to have the words put in their mouth, right? And, right. And that animates them, that gives them the breath of God or the breath of humanity, actually. But yeah, so he was animated by a drop of her blood. And that just felt like magic to me. I mean, that really just brought the whole thing together.
Yeah. And that really ties in that folktale side of it too. I mean, how many folktales rely on a drop of blood or the prick of the finger or that kind of thing? It's perfect.
Yes. And I just want to add to that book has a magical stripper named Jolene in it. And Jolene is pretty much the heroine. So I just want to add that in right there.
Another recent book sale I witnessed with my own eyes is a guy who was just bored out of his mind at a book festival that his wife dragged him to until he heard magical stripper. And then he bought your book right away.
That is exactly right. And his wife didn't even mind much.
No, she got a book in his hand, so she was happy.
That's right. That's absolutely right. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's sort of a create your own monster thing.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if now I can hit you with the simplest and toughest question of them all. Are you ready?
Uh-oh.
What is your favorite monster of all time? If you had to pick one, Laura Benedict, what's your favorite monster?
What's my favorite monster of all time?
And keep in mind, this episode will be airing the weekend before Halloween. So this is very much a Halloween episode. So okay, all the pressure's on.
I'm going to have to go with a sentimental favorite. I am going to go with Barnabas Collins from Dark Shadows.
From Dark Shadows, yeah.
The vampire Barnabas Collins. I mean, we do count vampires as monsters, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I do, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering, I'm like, he's a monster, right? I, you know, Barnabas Collins was one of my first crushes, I think, as far as monsters go. So yeah, Barnabas Collins.
Why Barnabas Collins of all vampires, or why did young Laura Benedict fall in love with this strange, weird, haircutted vampire of soap operas? He was cool though. I'm saying he was cool.
Well, you know, I was actually raised on soap operas, and you know, my mother, you know, and grandmother, you know, watched Days of Our Lives and Young and the Restless, and you know, I learned so much about writing from soap operas, particularly drama and character arcs, and just sort of doing imaginative things with characters, right? And so, Dark Shadows was a great soap opera. It really just was a soap opera. And there was something I liked about Barnabas was he was a vampire, but you couldn't ever take him too seriously as a vampire. So he was like a really accessible vampire. He seemed like a vampire you'd kind of want to get to know. So there you go.
Yeah.
So that's why, I never looked to date a guy who looked like Barnabas because he did have that weird haircut, but he seemed like he had a pretty good sense of humor.
Yeah. So you're going with the vampire that you could invite into the house then, I think.
Exactly. So, exactly. Yeah. And he turned into a bat, which was very cool.
Yeah, it's too bad that more vampires these days in film or movies can't do the bat transformation, because that seems essential.
Well, you know, Anne Rice ruined that, right?
You blame Anne Rice? I think you're right about that.
I blame Anne Rice, yeah. Yeah, because she said, because I actually had never, I had never read Interview with a Vampire. How embarrassing is that? Until like recently. And I was very upset when I learned that they couldn't turn into bats. It just seemed wrong.
Yeah, I think it was, I think in a recent episode, which will have aired by now, Tom Shippey said, vampires and werewolves are about the same, because werewolves are men who turn into wolves, and vampires are just kind of men who turn into bats. They're pretty much just bat people, right? And I thought, well, kind of, yeah. I mean, So, well, I really enjoyed this conversation, and I think we've filled up about our 40 minutes. I'm wondering if we could leave listeners with an idea of some places where they can connect with you, follow you, website, blog, books. Where should they go to find out more about Laura Benedict and the kind of stuff that she's up to?
Well, thank you for asking. Of course, laurabenedict.com has all the links and resources. I am particularly active on Instagram. That's my favorite. I'm pretty visual. I love to put up pictures. I love to see what other people are doing, and occasionally on Facebook and Twitter, but really Instagram. And also I blog at a place, and this is a really good resource for writers. It's called the Kill Zone blog, K-I-L-L-Z-O-N-E blog. And at Kill Zone, we're a group of primarily thriller writers who blog about writing. And you would not believe some of the great information you can get there. it's a lot of fun. So come check it out. I blog every other Wednesday, but there are a lot of people worth listening to.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Laura, for talking with me on the Monster Professor about ghosts and the gothic and sewing people together and Barnabas. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Josh. This was really a thrill, and I very much appreciate it.